This is a summary of Fear by bestbookbriefings.com. Trump in the White House. By Bob Woodward. The Tea Party Movement. In August 2010, 6 years before taking over Donald Trump's winning presidential campaign, Steve Bannon, a producer of right-wing political films, answered his phone. "What are you doing tomorrow?" asked David Bossie, a longtime House Republican investigator and conservative activist. He had been working with Trump for months, and Trump had asked for a meeting. Bannon agreed to go to New York City to meet Trump. Trump greeted them warmly, and Bannon was impressed with the showmanship, and increasingly so as Trump talked. Bannon explained what was driving the Tea Party, which did not like the elites. Populism was for the common man, knowing the system is rigged. It was against crony capitalism and insider deals which were bleeding the workers, and that is where Trump is a unique asset came in. 6 years later, Donald Trump accepted the Republican nomination on July 21, 2016. Bannon strongly believed that Trump could win. He clarified the difference between him and Hillary Clinton. He said that Hillary is the past and she is the tribune of a corrupt and incompetent status quo of elites who are comfortable managing the decline, while Trump is the tribune of the forgotten man who wants to make America great again. He said that they are going to achieve that in three themes. First, stopping mass illegal immigration and start to limit legal immigration. Second, bringing manufacturing jobs back to the country. Third, getting out of these pointless foreign wars. Bannon added that Trump had another advantage. He spoke in a voice that did not sound political, while Clinton spoke like a trained political. She sounded like she was lying. The election day. By the end of the election night, the AP called Wisconsin for Trump at 2:29 a.m. and declared him the winner. Trump went to speak to the crowd at the New York Hilton in Midtown Manhattan. "Now it's time for Americans to bind the wounds of division. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans," Trump said. The Russian intervention. After the election, President Obama directed his intelligence chiefs to produce a highly classified report on Russian election interference. Later, James Clapper, director of National Intelligence, summarized the key judgments, the heart of any intelligence assessment, as following. Russia had a long-standing desire to undermine the U.S.-led liberal democratic order, but in the 2016 presidential election, there was a significant escalation in directness, level of activity, and scope of effort. Putin ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. "We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. When it appeared to Moscow that Secretary Clinton was likely to win the election, the Russian influence campaign began to focus more on undermining her future presidency. Despite the previous results, there was no suggestion that Trump or his associates had colluded or coordinated with the Russian effort." The economy. Gary Cohn, the president of Goldman Sachs, came to talk with Trump about the economy at Trump Tower. Cohn told Trump, "The American economy was ready to experience a growth explosion if these three topics were taken into consideration. First, tax reform and removal of the shackles of overregulation." Cohn told the president-elect, "We are a trade-based economy. Free, fair, and open trade was essential." That was something Trump did not want to hear, as he had campaigned against international trade deals. Second, the employment picture was so favorable that the United States would run out of workers soon. Therefore, immigration to the United States had to continue. "We have many jobs in this country that Americans won't do." Third, interest rates were going to go up over the near future. Cohn said that the right thing to do, with rates increasing, the insurance companies and the pensions will lend the government money for 50 years or 100 years, and you could probably do it at 3.75%. That would be cheap money over the next 50 to 100 years. "Wow," Trump said. "That's a great idea." NATO. During the campaign, Trump disparaged the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Trump had argued that NATO might be obsolete. Much of his criticism had to do with money. NATO's goal was for each member nation eventually to spend 2% of its GDP on defense. The United States spent 3.5% of its GDP, while Germany spent only 1.2%. Secretary of Defense James Mattis convinced Trump with the importance of NATO to America, he said, "If you didn't have NATO, you would have to invent it." In his speech in Munich on February 15, Secretary Mattis found middle ground. "America will meet its responsibilities," he said, "but would moderate its commitment if the other NATO countries did not meet theirs." Nonetheless, he said the alliance was fundamental bedrock of U.S. policy. North Korea. Trump had a history of public statements about North Korea. In May of 2016, he told Reuters, "I would have no problem speaking to Kim Jong-un as president." In 2017, he called Kim a smart cookie. 2 days after the election, Obama and Trump met at the White House. The meeting continued for over an hour. "Korea is going to be the biggest, most important thing you have got going," Obama told the president-elect. North Korea was accelerating both its missile and nuclear weapons programs at an astonishing rate, and would, well within a year, have a ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon that perhaps could reach the United States mainland. On September 3, North Korea conducted an underground test of its most powerful nuclear weapon, its sixth. This was at least 17 times more powerful than the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima in 1945. Early in 2018, however, the CIA concluded that North Korea did not have the capability to deliver a missile into the United States mainland with a nuclear weapon on top. Nevertheless, they were marching toward that goal. THAAD. During a spring meeting in the Oval Office, discussion turned to the controversy in South Korea about the deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, THAAD, missile defense system. The system would help protect South Korea from a North Korea missile attack. More crucially, it could be used to help protect the United States. "Have they already paid for it?" Trump asked. "They didn't pay for it," McMaster said. "We paid for it." "That can't be right," Trump said. He wanted an explanation, so McMaster, the National Security Advisor, set out to get some answers from the Pentagon. "This is a terrible deal. Who negotiated this deal? What genius? Take it out. The major missile defense system might cost $10 billion over 10 years, and it was not even physically in the United States," Trump said. McMaster set up a National Security Council meeting in the Situation Room for January 19, 2018. Trump got right to his point. "What do we get by maintaining a massive military presence in the Korean Peninsula?" Mattis explained that the benefit was immense. "We get a stable democracy in a part of the world where we really need it," Mattis said. South Korea was one of the strongest bastions, free elections and a vibrant capitalism. "We're doing this in order to prevent World War III. The Middle East." Derek Harvey, the director for the Middle East on the National Security Council staff, "Number one worry in the Middle East was Hezbollah, the Iranian-supported terrorist organization." Harvey argued there was potential for a catastrophic war, with immense humanitarian, economic, and strategic consequences. "An Iranian-Israeli conflict would draw in the United States and unhinge efforts to bring regional stability." Harvey went to see Jared Kushner. "What do you think about the president going to Riyadh as our first presidential trip?" Kushner asked. "It fits perfectly with what we're trying to do," Harvey said. "Making Saudi Arabia the first presidential trip could go a long way to signaling that the Trump administration had new priorities." Kushner told Harvey he had important and reliable intelligence that the key to Saudi Arabia was the deputy crown prince, the charismatic 31-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS. Trump went to Saudi Arabia from May 20 to 21 and was lavishly welcomed. He announced $110 billion in Saudi-funded defense purchases. Syria. Donald Trump phoned James Mattis at the Pentagon on the morning of Tuesday, April 4. It was the third month of his presidency. Pictures and videos of a sarin gas attack on Syrian rebels were flooding into the White House. "Let's kill him," the president said. "Let's go in. Let's kill the lot of them." Trump sounded personally attacked. Syria had promised not to use chemical weapons. At the NSC meeting, three options were presented: hot, medium and cold. The largest option was a 200 missile attack on all the major Syrian airfields, the medium option was 60 missiles, and the smallest was almost none or none at all. The middle option advocates worked the president. Their argument was that this was not designed to start a war. It was really a messaging operation, designed to avoid one. Trump then gave permission to proceed for his first significant military action. Afghanistan. Trump was one of the most outspoken foes of the 16-year-old Afghanistan war, now the longest in American history. On March 28, McMaster proposed what became known to the NSC staff as the R4S, Reinforce, Realign, Reconcile and Regionalize. Trump approved McMaster's 4RS. Summarized in a 60-page strategy memo dated August 21 signed by McMaster, they were formalized as 1. Reinforce, provide more equipment and training but leverage support with conditions to drive reforms. 2. Realign, U.S. civilian assistance and political outreach will be realigned to target key areas under government control with contested areas considered on case-by-case basis. 3. Reconcile, diplomatic efforts will urge government to undertake broader efforts to foster inclusivity in political accommodation, promote elections, and conduct outreach of ethnic and regional power brokers. 4. Regionalize, work with regional actors. Trump's presidency. Before the president went up to the residence at the end of each day, Porter, his secretary, used to hand him a briefing book with his schedule for the next day. The next morning Trump would come down to the Oval Office at 10 a.m. and would say, "What's on my schedule for the day?" Trump liked to do things spur of the moment. He acted like doing too much advance preparation would diminish his skills in improvising. All presidencies are audience-driven, but Trump's central audience was often himself. He kept giving himself reviews. Most were passionately positive. Much of his brain was in the press box. In foreign affairs, it was about personal relationships, Trump explained to those who spent the most time in the Oval Office. "I have really good relations with Xi," he said about the Chinese president. On matters in which Trump had developed decades of opinions, arguments were pointless. Trump repeatedly said he was going to get out of the trade deals and impose tariffs. Several times, he said, "Let's do it," and asked for an order to sign. "We've got to distract him from CORUS," Porter said to Cohn. "We've got to distract him from NAFTA." Cohn agreed. At least twice, Porter had the order drafted as the president had directed. At least twice Cohn or Porter took it from his desk. The Russian investigation. John Dowd, one of the most experienced attorneys in white-collar criminal defense, was appointed to defend Trump in the Russia investigation being launched by special counsel Robert Mueller. Dowd and his team went to see Mueller and his team. Mueller's team dictated 49 questions. Nearly all concerned Trump's attitude, opinions, decision-making or conclusions about major information. Some inquired about Donald Jr. and the famous meeting at Trump Tower, and the offer from a Russian lawyer to provide dirt on Hillary Clinton. Others concerned real estate development in Russia. To have Trump answer them, of course, would be a catastrophe because Trump could erupt and say absolutely anything. The 49 questions troubled Dowd. "Why are not they just 5? Mr. President," Dowd said, "it isn't a few. There's 49 of them. I cannot, as a lawyer, as an officer of the court, sit next to you and have you answer these questions when I full well know that you're not really capable." Dowd said, "You do have trouble staying on the subject, and that can defeat you. Then you try to catch yourself, and you misstate something, and bam." On March 22, Dowd called the president and said he was resigning, after the president decided to testify. "I'm sorry, I am resigning. But if you're not going to take my advice, I cannot represent you." "I understand your frustration," the president said. "You've done a great job." Dowd remained convinced that Mueller never had a Russian case or an obstruction case. He was looking for the perjury trap, and in a brutally honest self-evaluation, he believed that Mueller had played him. Dowd believed that the president had not colluded with Russia or obstructed justice. However, in the man and his presidency, Dowd had seen the tragic flaw. In the political back and forth, the evasions, the denials, the tweeting, the obscuring, crying, fake news, the indignation, Trump had one overriding problem that Dowd knew but could not bring himself to say to the president: "You're a liar." Whether you prefer to read or listen, we have something for you. Visit bestbookbriefings.com now for more summaries.